This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 13th episode and the first episode of our second season. Today, we will review an important article in the JCENM looking at acute complications of Cushing's syndrome that I think will impact our practice as endocrinologists. It is another observational study, so we will do our usual close examination of the inferential methods to better assess the strengths and weaknesses of this paper. I'm excited to continue hosting Endocrine Feedback Loop for our second year. I am at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, where I work as a general endocrinologist and serve as one of the associate program directors for our fellowship. As our regular contributor for this episode, I welcome back Amalie Siracina. She comes to us from Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She is also a general endocrinologist in addition to being the director of their fellowship program. Today's guest expert is Shlomo Melmed. He has been at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, California for many years and is one of the world's experts in pituitary disease, including Cushing disease. He holds many roles in leadership and education at Cedars-Sinai, and many of us know him as the editor of Williams' textbook of endocrinology. So as you can tell, we've got a great team today to help us dissect this article. As usual, everything we say will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Our article today is Acute and Life-Threatening Complications in Cushing's Syndrome, Prevalence, Predictors, and Mortality. The paper comes to us from the University of Vienna in Austria with Marie-Helena Schoenthanner-Reiter as the first author. It was published in the May edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Now I'll turn things over to Amalie. She will review the introduction of this paper, and Shlomo will help us better understand the larger landscape of Cushing's syndrome along the way. Amalie?
Well, thank you for that introduction, Chase. I think the feedback loop has been a great success in the first year, and I'm really happy that the Endocrine Society is putting this on, and thank you for including me. So yes, our article today, as Chase mentioned, is focused on Cushing's syndrome. So Cushing syndrome, as we all know, is rare, but it's one of the most challenging conditions that we as endocrinologists will face. And it can have as high as a sevenfold increased mortality rate. And we all know that hypercortisolism affects multiple organ systems, leading to several different disease manifestations. The authors give a little bit of background about the main causes of death for patients with Cushing syndrome. So they list infection, cardiovascular disease, and pulmonary embolism. So in thinking about the physiology of Cushing syndrome, we know that cortisol excess can lead to chronic immune suppression, which can lead to infections. We also know that glucocorticoid-induced hypercoagulability can put patients at risk for thromboembolic events. So I wanted to ask our expert speaker, what are your thoughts on why Cushing's is such a challenging condition for to recognize, diagnose, and treat?
Well, thank you. That's a very important question. And I think the authors of this terrific paper were very challenged to try and help us answer that question. And they did an admirable job, given all the limitations, which I'm sure we will discuss momentarily. But the reason, to directly answer your question, the reason why it is so challenging to make a diagnosis is, firstly, that Cushing's is very rare, especially pituitary Cushing's. And pituitary Cushing disease, depending on which studies you look at, really has an annual incidence of 1 to 3 per million, which is a very rare disorder. And in contrast, the symptoms associated with Cushing's are very common: diabetes, hypertension, obesity, acne, mental disturbance. So a clinician is faced with a patient with a very, very common symptom, with a possibility of a very, very rare cause for that common symptom. So that incongruity puts the physician in a very, very difficult diagnostic challenge of having to balance the commonality of the symptoms versus the rarity of the etiology. A second reason why it's so challenging is that on good imaging, MRI good imaging with 2 millimeter slices, a large fraction of tumors in the pituitary are not visible. And often the endocrinologist has to resort to referring a patient to surgery without a totally well-visualized pituitary mass. And that is challenging. If they resort to inferior petrosal sinus sampling, IPSS, that procedure also is very challenging for the performer, for the interventional radiologist. It is challenging in terms of side effects. And so there are a few select centers which do this procedure in a safe and efficient fashion. Thirdly, our assays are not that good. And many labs don't really have a very good, precise, reproducible assay, especially for urinary free cortisol. And finally, probably the biggest challenge to answer your question is what the textbooks and the older literature terms cyclical Cushing's. I don't like that term. I'm not sure that cyclical Cushing's is a real diagnosis. I prefer the term variable Cushing's. These patients have variability in their lab results. And there are some studies which suggest that there may be a 100% variability in up to 15% of patients when repeating the testing for looking for Cushing's. So those are some of the reasons why it is such a challenge for the treating endocrinologist.
Yes, so that was a great summary. So a few points that the authors made in their introduction was that most prior studies looked at complications in patients with Cushing's syndrome compared to a normal population. And they later mentioned that, you know, we do have literature looking at sort of long-term complications of Cushing's syndrome. But these authors were interested in a bit more specific question, really looking at acute life-threatening complications necessitating either hospitalization or intensive care admission in patients with active Cushing's syndrome or right around, you know, their time of diagnosis and after surgical treatment. And they really wanted to evaluate what factors are associated with incidence of acute complications, ICU admissions, and mortality. So one thing that I noticed when we talk about our journal clubs and our program, we often focus on what was the question that the authors have or what is their hypothesis. So these authors didn't really state a hypothesis going in. It seemed more of maybe a descriptive look at their data. I don't know if others have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's always nice, and Molly, I agree with you. It's nice when a clearly stated hypothesis is there, so you can know exactly going into this study what the authors were hoping to prove with their analysis. So I don't know that it made a big difference in this particular investigation as to the results that the authors came up with, but it is always nice when it's stated as a hypothesis to begin that investigation.
I would concur with that, but we've got to give the authors a break on that topic because this is such a challenging topic. These are very sick patients. Controls are very, very difficult to recruit. Matched controls are extremely difficult. This is a very heterogeneous disease with a high morbidity and a high mortality. So I think by them focusing on hospitalization and on acute events is commendable. And although I agree with you, would it be nice to have a set hypothesis for assessment? And nevertheless, as descriptive studies goes, this is probably the best we're going to get for Cushing's for a long time to come.
And Shlomo's comments there are a great segue into the methods, because I think some of the points that he has raised already are ones that we want to think about exactly how the authors designed this study, given the substantial limitations that you've got for exactly the reasons that were outlined there. So first of all, what we're going to do, like we typically do, is take just a step back and think about several aspects of inferential methods, and particularly the ones that are used here, describe those in general, and then we'll dive into this particular paper to see how the authors wrestle with those issues. So first of all, is to think about the study design itself. So this is a retrospective cohort study. So as a reminder, we've looked at several of these before, but cohort studies, the way that those work is there is a time component. So at the very beginning of a study, you split the subjects of the study into groups based on an exposure. Now often, it's not the case here, but often you split them into two groups, one group that is exposed, one group that is not exposed. We'll see how the authors do that. It's a little bit different, but the key component to cohort studies is that you then follow these individuals over time, looking to see if one group versus another develops an outcome or outcomes of interest more frequently than another group does. And what makes it retrospective is that the study was started after all of the data was collected. Prospective studies are started at the very beginning, right after you split individuals into exposed and unexposed groups, and then you follow them. Retrospective, it's afterwards. And with retrospective studies, you are limited almost always to the information that's already available in your chart review, your database, which creates some other limitations that authors have to wrestle with. In this particular study, which we'll look at, the exposures are a little bit different. The entire cohort are individuals with Cushing syndrome, like Amali told us already. And then the exposure, as we'll see here in a second, is going to be the etiology, the cause of the Cushing. So everybody in this study has Cushing. There really aren't any controls of individuals who don't have that. So more on that in just a second. A couple of things that we always want to think about in observational studies are the possibility for bias and confounders. So a quick reminder of those. So a bias is simply what it sounds like from everyday use is treating one group different than another. And what happens in medical studies is a bias is because you know which exposure group one of your subjects is in, you may treat that patient differently. And in these sort of studies, it's not at all inappropriate for providers to be doing that. From the information that's out there already, there's a large amount of information that's known about the variability in the cause of the Cushing's. Just to state it generally, often ectopic Cushing is far worse than, say, adrenal Cushing. And so knowing that and knowing that the providers, the endocrinologists who were taking care of these patients while this data was being collected were aware of that, it is very reasonable to assume that they treated these individuals differently. That, for example, there may have been an ascertainment bias, that they were looking for these complications a little bit differently. And there may have also been some degree of a performance bias, that they were being treated differently, particularly those perceived to be at a higher risk of complication were treated differently. So we'll think about how the authors deal with that. I think they take several steps to help mitigate that, and they do a nice job. So we'll think about that as well. The last thing to think about is the possibility of confounders. A confounder is something that is related to what you have labeled as your exposure, but it's this related cause that's actually driving the outcome, not what you have actually labeled as your exposure. So we'll think about that here, but I think the one that instantly will come to mind for many of us is the possibility of malignancy, because some Cushing is caused by a malignant cause and some are benign, and that can make a big difference here. So we'll think about that. And again, think about how the authors deal with that, because I think they do a nice job of that. Okay, so those are some key things to keep in mind. Now we're going to dive back into this study in particular. So the authors of this investigation performed a retrospective cohort study using both inpatient and outpatient records of patients with Cushing at a single tertiary center, the Medical University of Vienna, and it was individuals who regularly attended the endocrine department there all the way from 1992 to 2017. So first of all, Amali, I know you had some thoughts as we were initially analyzing this article. You had raised a couple of concerns. The first one was about the possibility of a referral bias, and this is a single institution. So why don't you just quickly give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think anytime we're looking at a rare condition, getting enough of data in patients is always challenging. So there's certainly advantages to having a single tertiary center where some things like diagnosis and treatment may be a little bit more consistent. But one of the concerns we worry about is referral bias, that this may be a subset of Cushing's patients that are more complicated, more advanced disease. And maybe there are patients out there that are being managed, I guess, in Austria with their local endocrinologist, that maybe don't have as high a rate of complications. And so I think we have to keep that in mind when looking at the data from a single center.
Yeah, and I think that's just the right way of thinking about it is almost always these individuals, if anything, they're going to be sicker or have some degree of a worse course, and that is maybe what lands them in this center. So absolutely, always something that we have to be thinking of.
They may, in fact, have been transferred from one hospital to the tertiary hospital.
Correct. And whereas the more simple cases that were straightforward and easily taken care of without any complication stayed at, say, some other hospital, and they were never included here. So those are absolutely the right things to be thinking about. The other thing that Amali pointed out that I think we want to be considering here is that this is a lot of time. So Shlomo pointed out this is a very rare disease. And so if you're going to collect a lot of patients, you've got to include patients for many, many years. But this is a 25-year period, and there is almost certainly going to be an effect of evolving of treatment over that that time period. So Shlomo, this is a big question. So your challenge will be to give us a very concise answer, but give us an overview of how the care for Cushing has changed over 25-year period.
That's an excellent question for the study, especially if you look carefully at their data, that they say that they reported 23% of their hospitalized patients were hospitalized before the diagnosis of Cushing's. So that makes your question that much more relevant. What has happened over the last 25 years? And would that 23% number be lower today than it was 25 years ago, specifically because we are so much more aware of Cushing's today than we were 25 years ago, with the availability of sophisticated assays, sophisticated MRI, and the wonderful new advances in therapy. So there has certainly been, in our profession, an increased and an enhanced sensitivity to recognize Cushing's disease, specifically because it has become apparent more recently that even if we are able to control Cushing disease, which is so difficult, but even if we do control them, the patients are still prone to morbidity and mortality. The second big advance, I think, has been in the area of focused radiosurgery. And focused radiosurgery is relatively new in the history of our century. And so I think that patients receiving radiosurgery in the past 2 or 3 or even 5 years would have a different experience to conventional radiotherapy given 25 years ago. And then finally, most significantly, there have been a wonderful evolution of pipeline therapies, which are now available and approved, specifically somatostatin receptor ligands, which are uniquely designed for Cushing's disease, adrenal-directed treatments, glucocorticoid receptor inhibitors, and steroid synthesis inhibitors. And these new medications have certainly changed the therapeutic armamentarium, but we don't yet know what impact they will have on questions like these authors are asking as to what will those availabilities do to hospitalization and acute morbidity and mortality. So certainly 25 years has been a long panorama for Cushing's disease, and hopefully the latter 5 years would have resulted in a more favorable morbidity landscape.
Good. So important factors to keep in mind there. So as we think about the inclusion criteria for the study, so the big first one is that all of the individuals in this study had to have biochemically verified endogenous Cushing syndrome. And that could be pituitary, adrenal, or ectopic. And to make that diagnosis, first of all, of having Cushing, that required 2 positive tests of the following. So one version of a dexamethasone suppression test had to be positive, 24-hour urine-free cortisol, or midnight cortisol. So any 2 of those tests. And so another question then for Shlomo. So what are your thoughts on this criteria? Would this be relatively standard? Is there variation there? And then a second follow-up question about that is that the authors don't list the specific criteria for what constituted a positive test. And there are some debates, for example, around a dexamethasone suppression test. What truly is a positive test? And so is it important that we weren't told that information, or maybe not that big a deal? So what are your thoughts on those 2 issues?
Well, your question has been the subject of many workshops and consensus conferences without consensus being achieved, certainly in terms of the cutoff. I think the standard accepted cutoff today for a morning cortisol level after dex suppression is 1.8. And 1.8 seems to have a 95% sensitivity and an 80% specificity. So I think that cutoff would be important, and it would have been nice if the authors would have mentioned that what that was their cutoff. But I can assume, being in a good tertiary center, that that would have been their cutoff, that they do follow a standard criteria. But I was a little bit surprised that they didn't mention salivary cortisol. Midnight salivary cortisol in our hands has a very high sensitivity and specificity. Some of the literature suggests even a 95% sensitivity and specificity if it is assayed by a reputable lab. We would prefer that to a midnight cortisol level, because drawing cortisol at midnight is fraught with challenges. You wake the patient is stressed, they've got to be hospitalized. It's a clumsy test. So I would have preferred a midnight salivary instead of a midnight serum cortisol level. But otherwise, I think that their criteria were very standard, and they probably did not use salivary because, as you mentioned in your earlier question, 20 years ago, salivary cortisol levels weren't yet as routine as they are today. So I would suspect that if they redid their analysis and just focused on the last 5 years, they would have included salivary cortisol as one of their criteria for diagnosis.
One other comment on malignancy. That's another key component that's looked at here. That was based on histopathology or metastases. So if you had tissue that showed that the source of the Cushing was malignant, that would put you in that category. Or if you had imaging that showed metastases, then that would also put that there. So as an aside on this, we'll look at the results at the numbers that they have, but there are several cases of ectopic Cushing there where they could not find the source. It was occult. And it appears from the way the authors describe this that those are assumed to be benign. And almost certainly that would be the case, but is an assumption that we thought would be worth pointing out.
I'm not sure I would support that statement. I think that I have never seen ectopic Cushing's from a benign lesion. So I would have lumped them together. I would have lumped the 13 ectopic cases together with the 29 malignant cases and called them both ectopic. And your point of eight of them being occult is very significant. And I would assume actually that those eight occult patients really were harboring an occult malignancy. So I'm not sure why they distinguished ectopic from malignant.
And we'll come back to that because that has the possibility, because of the malignancy, of confounding some of the results. Yes. So I do think that distinction is important. So we will come back to the practical implication of that uncertainty and how the authors dealt with that. Also, for individuals, for subjects to be included, they had to have all of their records, had to be available from the outpatient visits, hospitalizations, and details of the surgery if they had that. And so they were not included if all that information was not available. A couple of definitions that the authors used that we thought were important to cover in detail. And the first one is describing the onset of Cushing. So the authors went back into the chart, did a retrospective review, and tried to determine the time of onset of symptoms of Cushing's. And this could be symptoms, comorbidities, or complications. And so that was a key component. And then based on that, they were able to calculate a couple of other things. One thing was diagnostic delay. So they were then able to calculate when they determined that symptoms or comorbidities or complications first showed up, and then to see when Cushing's was actually diagnosed to determine what that interval was. And then the second calculation that they did is to look at how long it took the individual to actually be cured or at least come under biochemical control of their Cushing with medical therapy. And again, dating that from the onset of symptoms or comorbidities or complications. And so what we wanted to do quickly as a group is just to discuss the difficulties in going back in a chart and trying to determine when Cushing may have started, for particularly the reasons that Shlomo mentioned, is that so many of the symptoms and signs are very nonspecific and are quite prevalent in the population.
I think that's a great question. So I would use the example of diabetes. I mean, how do we know when we see so many patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity, how would we record when their diabetes started? And so that's a very important question that you're asking. And I think it requires a very rigorous assessment. And if there's no accurate medical record, that question remains gray.
Good. So I think something to keep in mind, not that they shouldn't have done it or that it was inappropriate, but I think substantial limitations in at least the specificity of that calculation. All right, a couple of other things to talk about. So follow-up periods here. And this is how long they followed these individuals after they underwent some degree of treatment for their Cushing. So if the individual is determined to not have ever come under control for their Cushing, the authors included all of the data, all of the follow-up data that was available for these individuals. If the individuals were determined to have undergone successful surgical cure of their Cushing, then data was included up to 1 year post-op. And if the individuals went under medical management, if that was their treatment, then data was included only up until medical therapy was started. So as we were looking at this, Molly and I chatted about this for a while, we thought this was a little bit unusual and that there was variabilities, that with surgery, it was a year post-op, but with medical management, it was only once medical therapy was started. So we thought that was worth pointing out in discussion as a group, that it may be a little bit unusual as variable timing that was used there. So Molly, what are your thoughts on that?
When I was thinking, they didn't say, the authors didn't mention explicitly why they did this. I guess my best guess was that maybe the medications we all know have different side effects. And so maybe the concern was that It would be difficult to know if a complication was due to Cushing's or potentially a side effect from one of the treatments. So that might be a reasonable rationale. I don't know, Shlomo, if you had any thoughts as to why they did it this way.
I think that, that's a very important question. And I'm sure they grappled with it, especially when they saw their results, which maybe we'll talk about in a moment. But if their results are accurate, and we believe they are accurate, that over 50% of hospitalizations occurred in patients after surgery, after so-called success, two-thirds of them had remitted after surgery. So your question is very important. So if they would have gone out longer after surgery, they would have got more information. But that's a striking number, two-thirds of patients who have remitted, there's a 50% chance that they will still be hospitalized after surgery. I think understanding that timeline would be very important. And I'm sure the authors are looking at that right now, because that, I think, to me, was one of the most striking findings in this paper.
I think, fortunately, the way that they designed this study, I think that has a fairly limited impact. I think if this had been designed as the exposure looking at how the patients are treated, then I think it would be a deal breaker. You couldn't have variable follow-up periods there. Since this is really being designed with the exposure being the etiology of the Cushing, it maybe has a limited impact, though still a bit curious, as we said already, as to why different follow-up periods were used. A few other comments. So numerous baseline characteristics were looked at, and Molly's going to walk us through those here in a second in the results. And one final word here. So as far as what the authors were looking for, they looked at a variety. Their outcomes were acute complications and mortality. So first of all, for them to consider it to be an acute complication, it is something that had to require either a hospital admission or a prolonging of an existing hospitalization. And this, I think, was a really nice feature of what the authors did. And I think it helps limit the ascertainment bias. So to go back to that, ascertainment bias, again, is if you were looking for an outcome differently because you knew of which group a patient was in. This would be a very natural thing to happen. So if you're an endocrinologist, you know that ectopic Cushing can be really, really bad. And you may have a very, very low threshold if a patient has any symptom or any complaint whatsoever of looking for a blood clot or looking for an electrolyte abnormality. And so you may very well treat those individuals differently, and that would be appropriate to do that. I think what was nice is that they limited this analysis only to those that required a hospitalization. That probably mitigated that to some degree. It probably didn't get rid of the ascertainment bias altogether. But I think the hope here would be is that if it's something that was bad enough that caused you to be in the hospital or stay in the hospital longer, that is more likely that it would have been discovered regardless of how the provider was thinking about that individual. So the actual complications that they were looking at here, a big one was thromboembolic complications, and that could be stroke, PE, DVT, or peripheral artery embolism. They were looking at infections, at hypertensive crises, at arrhythmias, at electrolyte disturbances, at surgical complications, and finally, depression with suicidal ideation. So a lot of things to think about there in the methods. And Molly is going to walk us through the results now, and we'll look at a lot of this. She's going to really summarize this from a fairly high level because there is a great deal of data that's in this paper. So we're going to hit the highlights and deep dives as we need to along the way. So Molly, why don't you walk us through the results?
Sure. So the authors were able to identify 285 patients through their review with Cushing's syndrome. 24 were excluded due to lack of documentation, and 19 were excluded because they were lost to follow-up before surgery. So this left them with 242 patients. And then what the authors did is they divided those patients into benign and malignant.
Yeah, and I think this was really helpful here is to stratifying these individuals because of the possibility of confounding. So I think this really helped deal with that nicely, because I think there's always going to be a question of if you have a malignant cause of your Cushing and you have X, Y, or Z, I think a clot is a great example of that. Then your question is going to be, well, is it the hypercortisolism that's driving that, or is it some other aspect of the malignancy? So I think a very nice way that they dealt with that is just to separate these into two groups and did relatively few comparisons between these two groups. Now, I do think this goes back to Shlomo's point that you do have to wonder if those are accurately split into those two groups. But largely, I think that idea was a really good one and really helped deal with a very high likelihood of confounding with those two patient populations.
They were left with 213 patients with benign disease And of those 213, it was almost a 50-50 split between pituitary cause and adrenal. So they had 101 patients with pituitary Cushing's disease and 99 with adrenal Cushing's. And that left them with 13 ectopic Cushing's in the benign group. And then they had a group of 29 malignant Cushing syndrome. And within there was one pituitary carcinoma, 17 adrenal carcinomas, which were all female, which they pointed out was interesting, and 11 malignant ectopic Cushing syndrome patients. So then in the rest of the paper, they divided the benign Cushing syndrome and looked at that population. And so what they found, so their table one, which traditionally looks at the baseline characteristics of the group, was devoted to the benign Cushing syndrome patient. And they compared the ectopic patients to the pituitary adrenal. So I think to Shlomo's point, they're sort of identifying that what we already know is that the ectopic patients probably are a little bit different than the other population. So what they found in comparing them is that the ectopic Cushing's patients were older, they had a shorter duration of disease, and appear to have more severe cortisolism. So higher urinary free cortisols, higher cortisol levels, higher ACTH levels, and more diabetes. And I think this goes along, again, what we know empirically, that patients with ectopic Cushing's syndrome tend to have more severe disease and probably are diagnosed sooner. So then, as we've discussed, they observe these patients in a retrospective fashion. And so the average period of observation was 4.1 years, 3.1 years with hypercortisolemia. So I believe that's related to them observing the post-surgery patients for roughly a year. And then they looked at complications, ICU admissions, and death rates. Again, this is in the benign group. And as Shlomo alluded to earlier, it was quite striking that over half, so 54.5%, had some type of complication, and many patients had multiple complications. So when we look at the complications, what were the most common ones they saw? So the most common was infection. About a quarter, 25% of patients had some type of infection, either urinary tract infection, soft tissue infection, pneumonia, sepsis. And then second most common beyond that was thromboembolic event. And about 17% of patients, so stroke, pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis. Next was hypokalemia, and about 12.7%, which again, I think makes sense when we're thinking about the effects of hypercortisolism on the mineralocorticoid receptor. And then ICU admissions, and about 12%, 8% of those patients died. And their death rate was about 2.8%, or six people in this cohort. And these patients, again, had higher urinary free cortisol and higher hemoglobin A1Cs. So the timing, you know, we said that they are reviewing these charts retrospectively. So when did these complications tend to happen? So the authors noted that the hypertensive crisis, ischemic stroke, hypokalemia, and thromboembolism happened mostly while the patients were hypercortisolemic, and that when they looked at infections and acute coronary syndromes, myocardial infarction, those were equal while patients were hypercortisolemic and after surgery, when they were presumably not being exposed anymore to high cortisol levels. So they also looked at etiology. So least the patients that had adrenal Cushing's seemed to have the least complications, and patients, again, with ectopic Cushing's seemed to have the most complications.
Yeah, so I'll jump in here and just point out that this really nicely illustrates the dose-response relationship. I think this fits with many years of experience here with Cushing, but it is something when you look at observational studies that always helps you figure out if the results would be accurate or not. And that's to look back and say, well, if a little bit of something's bad for you, then a lot of something should be really bad for you. So it is something that you want to see, and it fits with adrenal Cushing. There are complications, but as you move up, there are more of those with pituitary, and then more still with ectopic. And so that goes along with what we know before and really is an encouraging finding and says that the authors have analyzed this correctly.
One of the goals of the authors had said in the beginning was to see if they could identify independent predictors of these things, such as complications and ICU stays. So after doing multiple analysis, the independent predictors that they came up with were urinary free cortisol. So the higher the urinary free cortisol, the more complications and the more days in the ICU, and the higher the hemoglobin A1C. So the higher that was, the more complications the patients had. And interestingly, the third one was LDL cholesterol, but it was actually the other way. So it was a negative association, that the lower the LDL, the more complications they saw. So the authors noted that patients with ectopic Cushing syndromes tended to have lower cholesterol levels despite worse metabolic status. And they thought this may represent hypocholesterolemia of the critically ill. But I thought that was interesting. So that was the benign group. So then they go on to describe the results for the malignant Cushing syndromes group. So these people had a shorter duration of diagnostic delay compared to benign.
And I'll jump in here and just say that this would be an area to where you would want to be careful about making a conclusion as to why that was the case. Totally fine what the authors did here in stating that it was a simple finding. You would have to be cautious, though, in saying that it was the degree of hypercortisolemia that was doing that. I think it could easily be the malignancy or some other aspect of that. So I think that's a really good example of why you would want to split those two things up, because we don't really know what aspect is driving that. And so always a bit of caution as to trying to figure out why that's the case. And probably best just to say that it's a combination of all the factors there that led to that.
So as we might hypothesize ourselves, the patients with malignant Cushing syndrome definitely had higher rates of complications. So 69% had an acute complication, and all of the patients with the ectopic malignant Cushing syndrome had some type of complication. Almost a quarter, so 24.1%, were admitted to the ICU, with 43% of those patients dying during their ICU admission, which is quite high. And they also quoted 59% mortality, and this, you know, likely would be even higher if you followed patients, because again, once a patient started on medical therapy, they stopped being followed in the study. So there were patients in the malignant Cushing syndrome that were started on medication and may have died later, but those would not have been captured.
All right, thanks, Amali. So a lot of numbers there. We're going to go back through as we walk through the discussions and conclusions. We'll hit some of the high points there, so I'll state some of those key numbers again just to drive those home. And then we're going to spend a while thinking about the implications of this study, particularly ending with, should this change our practice that we provide for our patients? So first of all, some of the points that the authors make, their main conclusion. So the primary complications that were identified here, infections, thromboembolism, hypokalemia, and hypertensive crises. So those are the big four things that they identified here. And if we look at how frequently those occur based on the etiology of the Cushing, just as the authors separated these groups. So 62% of those with benign pituitary Cushing, 62% had a complication. If it's adrenal, 40% had a complication. And if it was ectopic, 100% of individuals had one of these complications. And if we look at ICU admission, so 12% of those with benign disease ended up in the ICU. And if it was malignant, twice that, 24% of those ended up in the ICU. So some fairly striking numbers as far as those complications go. A couple things to think about. Authors point out a concern about diagnostic delay. So they point out that 23% of individuals were admitted to the hospital before Cushing was ever even diagnosed. And then of that large amount of people who were admitted to the hospital, a third still left the hospital without Cushing having been identified as the underlying cause for that admission. So we've talked about this already. Shlomo mentioned this at the very beginning, but I think it's worth circling back again on this to really point out that there are substantial challenges with recognizing and diagnosing Cushing here. So I think it's worth highlighting that we clearly see that in this study. I think those, Molly and I have work as general endocrinologists, I think this is a common thing. Even as endocrinologists, we have many, many individuals who have these comorbidities, who have diabetes and obesity and hypertension and numerous other manifestations of hypercortisolism. And so even for us, it can be hard to recognize that with how many patients that we see. So any other comments, Amali or Shlomo, just about how this illustrates this problem and how we need to be thinking about addressing that?
Yeah, I think you hit on a very important point, and that is the undiagnosed patient being admitted with a complication of Cushing's. And you know, there have been studies of trying to screen large populations of obese patients and diabetic patients and patients with acne or hirsutism, and trying to screen for Cushing's, and all of those, for obvious reasons, have failed miserably. And there is no practical way to do population screening. So the diagnosis relies on an astute endocrinologist who's able to put the puzzle together in a new onset, unexpected diabetes patient, a new onset, unexpected acne and hirsutism, or even the psychological change in the face of hyperglycemia. So it requires a very subtle and skilled diagnostician to really make the diagnosis before the disease becomes florid and apparent.
Yes, I give the lecture to the second year medical students about, you know, Cushing's, and I always tell them, you know, it's a unique opportunity to get to speak to people that are going to be all different types of doctors. And I tell them there's not a single, you know, area of medicine that Cushing's disease and Cushing's syndrome doesn't touch. So if you can be that person that at least recognizes or sees that something is a little bit discrepant, you know, but it as we've talked about, it's very challenging because these things are so common. And I think this study just drives that point home.
Yeah, and the study here illustrates not only challenges in recognizing it, but then what to do even after it's been recognized. So let's start walking through some of the implications of these complications that they found. So starting with thromboembolism, the authors point out that in their study, that mostly the venous thromboembolisms were identified preoperatively. And they suggested that a lot of this is because after the diagnosis had been made, that there was fairly frequent use of prophylactic anticoagulation. And I would say, unfortunately, they don't actually explain that in more detail. So they don't explain if that was a fairly standard practice in their group for anticoagulating these individuals either before surgery or perioperatively. So I think that would have been nice to know. But I think a really big question for us is seeing the frequency, how common it is for these individuals to have substantial blood clots, ones that land them in the hospital or at least keep them in the hospital longer. Where are our thoughts on, is this need to be a standard of practice? The authors point out that the most recent guidelines suggest that we consider that, but does that need to be more strongly considered? So Shlomo, can you help us understand that? Maybe what's your practice here? What would you advocate for once somebody has been diagnosed with Cushing, until their hypercortisolism is controlled, do they need to be prophylactically anticoagulated?
Well, that question is a question which is being considered right now by several centers who are trying to answer that question rigorously. And unfortunately, a design of a prospective control study is so difficult because of the challenge of a control population to really rigorously answer your question. And it's clear that from the literature that there's an 18 to 20 fold increase in venous thrombotic events in patients with Cushing's disease, of whom more than 20% occur post-operatively, even 30 or 40 or 60 days post-operatively. And you know, there are very sad anecdotes of patients undergoing successful resection of a small pituitary microadenoma, going home normocortisolemic, and then dying suddenly after 30 or 40 days. And so venous thromboembolism is a very significant complication. So I would be an advocate of prophylactic anticoagulation. Some authors have recommended using a score and bringing obesity, diabetes, and hypertension into that score as we would for any non-Cushing patients for risk of thromboembolism. But I think that overall, it's a clinical judgment. And even after successful pituitary surgery, my bias today, and it's not based on any rigorous study yet, would be to consider, especially in the obese patient, at least 60 days of prophylactic anticoagulation.
And I think Shlomo's point's a good one here, is that we may not in the future, or at least anytime soon, have an RCT that really helps us answer this question. So really what we may need to do is grapple with this data and similar studies to it and try to understand from that what would be a best practice. So then in a similar question then, as they talk about the frequency of infection. So that's the most common complication. Over 25% of individuals had infections. And actually all of the individuals who died, all of the non-survivors had an infection at some point. So a similar question then, is that something is prophylactic with some sort of antibiotic? So they mentioned in particular PCP is a fairly common infection. Do we need to also think about prophylactically giving antibiotics to these individuals, Shlomo?
I think that's a very important question. And I think one of the many striking highlights of this paper is that infection permeates everything. In every aspect, in every table, in every cohort, in every subgroup, infection is so important as a morbidity and a contributor to mortality in Cushing's disease in its broadest term. So I think that's a very important question, and we should be very, very sensitive to preventing infection. There's a curious observation, and it's being reported now in several studies, that, for example, for some of the rare fungi, there's a 60% mortality, even from pneumocystis. And if you look at patients who are immunocompromised from HIV, there's only about a 20 or 30% mortality. So there's clearly some underlying immune suppression in Cushing's, which is very, very powerful. And more concerning is the fact that when the hypercortisolemia is acutely controlled, you may unleash an occult infection. So we shouldn't be fooled by the normalization of cortisol levels and then believe that our patients are protected from subsequent infection. So I would be a strong advocate of prophylactic antibiotic or antifungal treatment for these patients.
Good. So a few other comments here. So the authors point out with ectopic disease that all of the individuals with ectopic disease had at least one complication. And I think that very nicely illustrates the need for in those individuals, not only to quickly diagnose, but to quickly, if you can, to control their hypercortisolism. And finally, they make a comment about the severity of the hypercortisolemia. So they point out, as Amali already told us, that the urinary free cortisol was the best predictor both of the number of complications, but also of the number of days in the ICU. And so one thing I had on this, and again, it's easy after the analysis has been done to think of other ways that it could have been done. But to me, it did make me wonder as if this study might have given us a bit more information if it had been designed with the exposure as the degree of hypercortisolemia. Now, I absolutely understand why the authors did it the way they did. Diagnostically, we think about it as endocrinologists the way that they arranged it. We think of trying to figure out what is the cause of the Cushing, and then obviously that drives how we would treat the Cushing. So that makes a lot of sense as to why they organized it. Though I would think, though, as far as complications go, knowing that dose response that we alluded to earlier, is that it is most likely, at least for many of these complications, the degree of hypercortisolemia that's driving the complications. And so at least make me wonder is if the results might be a bit more actionable if we understood how likely a complication was based on the degree of hypercortisolemia as opposed to the etiology. To give an example to where you could say, well, maybe if your 24-hour urine-free cortisol is below this cutoff, maybe your risk of complications is not particularly high, but if it's above this cutoff, it's awfully high, and you definitely need to think about prophylaxis of one form or another in those groups. So that was just a thought that I had. Again, always easy to Monday morning quarterback that after the hard work has been done by somebody else. But yeah, Shlomo, what are your thoughts?
I would take a bit of a different take on that, because you raise a very important point. And I'm struck by the fact that even without hypercortisolemia, even in the patients who are in so-called remission, they're still they're still requiring hospitalization. So I think that is also a very significant finding for us. We shouldn't be lulled by the fact that cortisol levels are normalized or even attenuated. And that's a very important lesson that I learned. There is another unrelated answer to one of your earlier comments on the topic of lessons learned. And I'm wondering if in Vienna, the criteria for ICU admission are different to here, because I was struck by the fact that only 24% of the patients with malignant Cushing's were in the ICU. And I'm wondering if in the USA, knowing our practice as we do, we would have admitted more patients to the ICU, because these were very sick patients. They had florid infections, which were often fatal. They had hypokalemia. They had thromboembolus. Those patients, I think, who have a 24% overall ICU admission, to me seemed a little bit low, and it could be a gatekeeper effect in this hospital, which is different to our practice here. So I think we should interpret that 24% with a little bit of understanding of the local rules.
Yeah, several good points there. So where I want us to end, I'm going to leave us with where the authors conclude, and then we'll give some of our thoughts about this study overall and how that should be impacting our practice. So first of all, I'll quote the authors here in their conclusion. Our findings emphasize the necessity to draw a special attention to the prevention, early detection, and treatment of acute complications, not only during active hypercortisolism, but also after successful surgery. So I think that was a nice, accurate, fair way that the authors described their findings and the implications of them. So I would like to hear both from Amali and Shlomo. What are your thoughts about, first of all, about this study overall, the quality of this report?
Yeah, I'll start. I agree. I thought it was a really great study. The fact that it is, Cushing's is such a rare condition. They had over 1,000 patient years, they mentioned, of clinical observation. So I think it was a really thorough study. As I mentioned in the beginning, Cushing's, and we've hit this point many times, Cushing's is extremely rare. But I think for the endocrinologist or the clinical endocrinologist like myself, a general endocrinologist, it's rare, but the Cushing's patients I have, I can tell you their name and they probably have my personal cell phone. And, it's a really challenging condition to manage. So I think for me, it brought home, maybe I wasn't as aware of some of the acute complications, such as thromboembolism and infection. And so even though we're not going to have a lot of randomized control trials data to rely on, I think it was really helpful and might be helpful to me next time I have a patient that I'm sending for surgery, bringing some of these things to the forefront, especially if you're in a place where maybe doesn't have a high volume of cases.
I concur with both of your comments, but I would just add that I think it's refreshing to see that a classification of Cushing syndrome that's not focused on ACTH dependency or independence shows us that it doesn't matter what the cause of the hypercortisolemia is. The distal impact is similarly deleterious. And I think that's a very, very, very refreshing aspect of this study, because most such studies or similar studies in Cushing disease will usually classify Cushing's as ACTH dependent or independent. So this approach, I think, is very refreshing and illuminating. I think they had a huge challenge. There's a massive data for a very, very heterogeneous set of symptoms, a very heterogeneous etiology set, and an inability to really control for their population groups. So I think given those constraints of this disorder, they did an admirable job of illuminating the points we've raised for us and for our patients. So we should commend them and thank them. And I just want to end off by saying that Cushing's disease remains a malignant disorder for endocrinologists. This is a very challenging disease. And despite all the therapeutic advances, we still struggle to make a diagnosis, and we struggle to control these patients, to treat them, and to prevent mortality. And if you look back at the original mortality after having Cushing's original descriptions, if you don't control patients, if their cortisol levels and hypercortisol limits are not controlled, the mortality levels and the mortality rates haven't changed much in almost 100 years. So this is a very challenging disease, and we should be really vigilant in making a rigorous diagnosis and maximally treating these patients with the tools that we have available.
Those are excellent points. And so Shlomo, I'm going to have you one last question for you to finish us off then. So I agree. I think this is an excellent report. A lot of limitations that the authors had to deal with out of necessity. And I agree. I think they did a very nice job with that. So with this information and knowing that RCTs are going to be fairly limited, particularly looking at these components of complications of Cushing. So this is going to be one of, if not the best studies that we have. So how should this change our practice? So either for you individually or as you think about participating in a guideline and advocating for care that, that everyone would provide, how would you see this report changing the practice that, that we as endocrinologists provide to our patients with Cushing's syndrome?
I think the two important lessons are, three important lessons actually from this paper are, number one, the importance of early diagnosis is re-emphasized. And we all know that, it's intuitive, but it's got to be stated. And then secondly, I think that anticoagulation and thirdly, prophylactic anti-infectious approaches should become standard of care. We should be more readily open to offering our patients prophylactic anticoagulation and prophylactic anti-infection treatment.
And with that, I would like to thank Amali Siracina and Shlomo Milmet for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal and know that you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.